This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Janet Mock is a writer, director, and producer of the FX series Pose, whose characters are part of the gay and trans ballroom scene of the late 80s and early 90s, the culture that inspired Madonna's 1990 hit record Vogue. The balls are celebratory, but it's the height of the AIDS epidemic, and a growing number of people in the community are dying. With Pose, Janet Mock became the first trans person of color to write and direct an episode of TV. She's drawn on some of her own experiences for the storylines. Pose has been renewed for a third season. Season 1 is streaming on Netflix. Season 2 is available through FX, on demand, and streaming. Pose was created by Ryan Murphy, who also created Glee, American Horror Story, and American Crime Story. Mock was a journalist and wrote 2 memoirs before working on Pose. Let's start with a clip that's set at one of the balls from an episode she wrote with Ryan Murphy. The balls are competitions in which the participants are judged on their costumes, dancing, or poses. The competitions have an MC who announces the theme or category and offers commentary on the costumes and moves. In this episode, the category is a dance style called lofting, and one of the girls, Candy, is dancing wearing a pointy bra bodice and pinstripe suit inspired by one of Madonna's outfits. Candy is a very unconvincing dancer. The MC, whose name is Pray Tell, mocks her in his commentary. Pray Tell is played by Billy Porter. Candy is played by Angelica Ross.
The category is called lofting. It is a dance category for actual dancers. We've been down this road before. You are not a dancer. You are not a voguer. And quite frankly, I'm concerned about your health. Breakdancing might burst that silicone. And you don't want to go back to that flat ass you used to have now, do you?
Why are you always reading me the riot act, pray tell? You go out of your way to put me down.
I don't have to put you down when you're always in the bottom.
You stood up there on your perch talking about it's our time. Our time to be seen. To show the world what we got.
That's right.
But in this room, you the only one that refused to see that I got something to contribute. I got heart. I got talent. I'm a star just like Madonna.
Okay. Judges, your scores. 5, 5, 0. I don't know what to tell you, girl. The cards don't lie.
You gonna regret your words. I'm a star. I know who I am.
Yes, you are.
I am somebody.
Okay, you go on ahead and be somebody, Miss Jessie Jackson. Just not on my floor. Music, please.
That's a scene from Pose. Janet Mock, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe the ball culture that's at the center of Pose.
Well, the ball culture is a space started in uptown Manhattan, in Harlem. It was created by a group of black trans women and drag queens who were tired of being pushed out of white drag spaces where they kept on being upstaged and not given titles, and the titles were favored to white queens who embodied, Western culture's idea of beauty and femininity more than the black and brown queens did. And so Crystal LaBeija created the scene, and it has become this kind of community space, one where a lot of orphan people, you know, homeless folk, trans and queer people gather together in houses, where there's often a mother and a father who is the head of the household, who takes in kids, takes in young people, takes in queer folk who've been rejected by their own families, and takes care of them, offers them food, shelter, clothing, life experiences, advice, and they go into a ballroom, which can be a gym, a recreational center, a YMCA, a theater that they rent out for an evening to compete in categories such as realness, such as runway, such as Vogue, and they get to live out their fantasies with one another and celebrate one another.
Yeah, so each house is kind of like a family of choice.
Yeah, it's the idea of chosen family, which LGBTQ folk know all too well for their own survival.
So have you ever been part of ball culture?
I've never been a part of the ball culture. My first experience of the ball world was through Jenny Livingston's documentary, Paris is Burning. I believe I was in the 10th grade. My friend had a VHS that she got from another friend. It was kind of like this little, magical ticket that was passed down to a bunch of us. And I remember seeing it and just being agape, just in awe of the fact that this community existed and that someone was smart enough to pick up a camera and document their lives. I felt so seen for one of the very first times in my life.
That's an important age to feel validated.
It deeply is. And for me, at that time period, I was just embarking on my own transition. I had already socially transitioned from the eighth grade onward, and between ninth and 10th grades, I was embarking on my medical transition in Hawaii. And in Hawaii, what was so great is that we had our own community of trans people and LGBTQ folk that I grew up around, but it was a whole nother thing to see people who were Black and brown, who looked like me, travel those same roads that I was about to embark on.
Pose is groundbreaking, not just because the characters are trans, but also because there's trans actors. You're trans as a writer, director, and producer. And I'm wondering how it feels for you to have work in which you're not seen as different.
It's a bizarre and strange universe that we get to do this, you know, and be supported by a network and by a studio. The fact that I get to go on set and supervise production, write scripts, direct, it's astounding. You know, I watch the monitors sometimes and I'm realizing as I'm sitting there watching it, sometimes with tears in my eyes, realizing that these were the sort of stories that I was craving as a young person, and there's no othering in it. There's no over-explaining of our experiences. It's just welcome to our world. That's how it often feels. When we're doing those ball scenes and sequences, our choreographers are from the ballroom community. They're LGBTQ of color, people of color. There are hundreds of background actors who oftentimes are getting their first SAG cards because of being on our show, who are often getting their first experiences on a set, whose eyes I see widen, realizing, oh, wow, I belong in this space and I'm welcomed and maybe I can go off and do background work on other productions. And I've seen them, and I've seen them in other productions like Tales of the City. I've seen them in the background and I'm like, wow, they got their start on our series. And it's such a strange experience. It's so surreal. But for me, it feels, though it's oddly become the norm, I realize, at least in our world, it's the norm, but I realize that it's a completely rare experience.
So I want to get to a clip from that first episode that you both wrote and directed, which gave you a place in TV history as the first trans person of color to write and direct an episode of TV. So here's the setup to the clip. In the previous episode, Angel, one of the trans women, has been having an affair. Well, throughout the series, she'd been having an affair with a young married man, and she loves him, but after things get more serious, she breaks off the relationship because he's married. His wife, Patty, figures out that he's been having an affair and tracks down Angel. She even goes to see her at one of the balls. Patty is pretty clueless about what's happening at the ball, and after it's over, asks Angel to talk. So at the beginning of your episode, the following episode, they meet in a restaurant. Angel is played by India Moore. Patty, the wife, is played by Kate Mara. She speaks first.
What were you doing in that big hall with all those gay men and drag queens?
That's my home.
You live there?
No, honey. My community. Mi familia.
But how could a woman be a drag queen?
I'm a transsexual.
No, I don't believe you.
Why, thank you. It's a compliment, you know?
No, that's not possible. I mean, Stan would never do that. You're a woman.
100%.
Prove it.
What, you want to see my d-?
Yes.
I'm sorry for what I did to you. And I'm here to talk. But I got boundaries. I'm not bothered by any part of who I am except that. Everything I can't have in this world is because of that thing down there. If you want to see who I am, that's the last place you should look.
It's a scene from Pose, written and directed by my guest, Jenna Mock. So the last line in that scene, if you want to know who I am, that's the last place to look. Did you write that line?
I did. It was one of those things that I've always wanted to say.
I was wondering if you ever actually said that to someone. It's a great line.
Thank you. I, you know, having done this work, public work, for so long, and part of my public work is talking about my life experiences and what I've gone through. I've been very transparent about my struggles with my body and with a society that is constantly trying to contain me and label me and define me. I've spent my entire youth and life fighting against that. And so one of the great gifts of writing for television and writing for these characters is all the things that I may not have been bold enough to say in an interview or at a dinner party when someone finds out that I'm trans, or, you know, I bring it up in my work and they're astounded and they start asking all of these strange, invasive questions. I may not have been bold to say that. I just want to get through the dinner party, have a glass of wine, you know, continue on with the meal. But for Angel, she can say the things that I've always wanted to say, which is, you know, the things that I've had to do medically to my body don't define me. They're the least interesting things about me. And the fact that they're the most sensational things for you as a non-trans person, as a cis person, I think says a lot about how we've framed trans people as these objects of dissection, of modern day freak shows in a way. Ever since we saw, you know, Christine Jorgensen get off of that plane in the 1960s and telling her story for the first time, and it just being really about her struggle with her body, and not so much about, you know, the ways in which our society continues to box us in and makes us have to fight and defend ourselves and our bodies and our identities.
When you were growing up, your parents separated when you were very young. You were born in Hawaii, spent your first few years there. Then you moved with your father to Oakland. And then, I think when you were around 12, moved back to Hawaii to be with your mother. Mm-hmm. And when you were growing up with your father, he thought that you were a sissy, and tried to, like, get you to, you know, be more brave about riding a bicycle and to, like, sports and stuff like that. What did he try to do to, like, get you to, like, you know, man up or boy up when you were a kid? And what was your reaction to that?
Me and my father have a very complicated relationship even to this day. My father took it upon himself as a part of his duty to toughen me up, to push me down purposely on the ground and make me get up and not cry. He put it upon himself to, you know, play baseball and basketball with me, to force me to play tackle football, to do all the things that traditionally boys are supposed to want to do, when all I wanted to do was, you know, play jacks and jump rope with my cousins and read books in the corner in a quiet space. But those things were seen as feminine things, as girl things to do in the world. And, you know, my dad is a black man from the South, from Louisiana and Texas. He's the eldest of five. He was in the military. He was a womanizer. For him, he was so traditionally hyper-masculine to the point of toxicity that, you know, for him to have a child, his firstborn son, who was his namesake, to walk around in the world with long curly hair and swishing hips and wanting to giggle and laugh and skip around with his girl cousins, to him, it was a great insult. And I think also, because he loved me, because I was his child, I think he thought that he was protecting me. Mm-hmm. He was protecting me from a world in which I was already black. So why would I want to add on other labels and marginalized selves, like being gay? And at that point for him, he had no consciousness of transness. Why would I want to add that on to my struggle and my burden?
He asked you at one point if you were gay, and it was a hard question to answer because he saw you as a boy, you saw yourself as a girl. Mm-hmm. You were attracted to boys, but if you're a girl attracted to boys, you're not gay. So it was a complicated question, and your father, of course, was clueless about how complicated it really was. What went through your mind when he asked you that, if you don't mind me asking you?
Well, the first thing I thought was, how am I going to get out of this? like, as any kid, you know that you're in trouble. And I also saw, even at that age, you know, as a memoirist, you can write about the immediacy of being in that car as your young self with your father. And then you can editorialize it with time and look back, you know, decades removed. And even at that time in that car with my dad, I felt his vulnerability. I felt his fear for me. I felt his deep love for me. But I also felt as a child that I needed to lie to him in a sense. I needed to assuage his fears. I needed him to know that things would be okay. And though I didn't in the time period feel like I was lying, because to say that I was gay was not an identity that I felt, that a lot of the things that I was going through weren't necessarily about my sexuality. They were about my gender. I didn't have those terms at that time. I didn't know that gender identity is who you go to bed as versus sexual orientation is who you go to bed with. But at that time period, I just knew that my dad wanted the answer to be, no, Dad, I'm not gay. And so I just lived in that truth of that at that time period. And even though I answered that way, I still went home and got punished. He buzzed off all of my hair, which for me at that point was my only expression of my femininity that I had control of. He let my hair grow long, and he wanted to strip that away of me. He wanted to show that I was a boy. He wanted to prove that to himself, to me, and to the world around him.
Do you remember the first time you went outside fully expressing yourself as a woman?
I was in the seventh grade. I was dressed up in a black and white checkered halter top and bell bottoms, platform heels that I borrowed from my best friend Wendy, who was also a trans girl that I grew up with, and her short Toni Braxton bobbed wig. I felt so pretty to go to a middle school party. We performed as the Spice Girls, of course, because I was the only black girl. I was Scary Spice, which to this day, I'm like, what a gift, because she's my favorite Spice Girl. And I just remember us being applauded and being celebrated. And for me, those are things that I wish I had more of growing up. I wish that when I walked down the halls in my high school that I wasn't always just gawked at and jeered at, that I was cheered on, that teachers called me by my chosen name, that they didn't misgender me, that they didn't send me to the principal's office when I wore a skirt, that instead I was allowed to just sit in the room like another student and learn. But instead, oftentimes, my identity became a barrier for people to see that I was just a student, that I was just a young person, that I was just trying to make a way for myself and to claim space.
Are you kind of amazed to see the difference in understanding in our culture about what it means to be trans now compared to when you were a child? And I'm not saying things are great or easy, but I think there's been a lot of progress.
There's so much progress. You know, growing up in Hawaii, trans people were a part of my everyday. And so I'm so happy that now we're kind of seeing with, you know, visible figures like Laverne Cox and Isis King, who was just in Ava DuVernay's When They See Us.
And you?
I'm seeing, yeah, and me. And the cast of Pose. And Hunter Schafer on Euphoria on HBO, that there's so many more representations of trans folk existing in the everyday on people's televisions. And I just hope that this continues to evolve, that our visibility leads to progress, leads to better laws, leads to more protection, and leads to a world in which we no longer have to continue to say the names of trans women who were slain for simply being themselves and existing in their communities.
Janet Mock, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry. I'm such a huge fan and listener of Fresh Air, and so it's such an honor to be on the other side of your questions and your insightful, such sensitive narrative. Thank you.
Janet Mock is a writer, director, and producer for the FX series Pose. Late summer is usually a drowsy time in the book world, but a recently published debut memoir called The Yellow House has become one of the most talked about books of the 2019 publishing season. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
When Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans on August 29, 2005, writer Sarah M. Broom was living in New York City, far away from her hometown and her family. In her extraordinary debut, a memoir called The Yellow House, Broom quotes from interviews with her mother and some of her 11 siblings to piece together the story of what happened when the water roared into their neighborhood of New Orleans East and rose up, up, up until it edged the tops of the houses. Their fragmented recollections, immediate, raw, sometimes profane, and even funny, add to the growing archive of testimonies about the harrowing of New Orleans. After the water receded, there were two belated casualties. Broom's grandmother, Amelia, fell ill during the exodus and died a month later. The other casualty was the Yellow House itself, a much-tinkered-with camelback shotgun house where Broom and almost all her siblings grew up. Here's a snippet from Broom's description of the post-Katrina visit she and her family members paid to that house. The house looked as though a force, furious and mighty, crouching underneath, had lifted it from its foundation and thrown it slightly left. Once having done that, it had gone inside to my sister Lynette's and my lavender-walled bedroom and extended both arms to press outward until the walls expanded, buckled, and then folded back on themselves. The house had split in two, the original structure separated from the later addition that my father built. We did not enter, even though the house we knew beckoned. We stayed outside, looking through the one big crack. Broom's memoir itself is a force that cracks open that little yellow house and exposes the decades of life lived within. The meals, the fights over the two bathrooms, the dreams, the indestructible flying cockroaches, the parties and weddings, and out-of-the-blue tragedies. One of the most compelling presences in this book is Broom's mother, Ivory May, who bought the Yellow House in 1961 with insurance money after the death of her first husband. A 19-year-old widow with two children and pregnant with a third, Ivory May quickly remarried. Her second husband, Simon Broom, had a steady job in maintenance at the nearby NASA plant. But Simon died 6 months after Sarah was born. That's when something began to gather strength, fester, and spread throughout the house. As the youngest child, the babiest in this large family, Broom was too young to witness what she calls the original shifty settling in of shame, but she lived with its consequences. After her father's death, the house, which was always in disrepair, grew more dilapidated and stayed that way. Electricity would erratically cut off, rooms were framed, but walls were never inserted, and repairs relied heavily on masking tape. The children caught on quick that no one but family should be invited inside. Along with everything else it illuminates, the Yellow House offers a searing evocation of the long-term toxic consequences of shame. Outside the tight confines of Broom's house, her neighborhood of New Orleans East, promoted in the booming post-war era as a middle-class suburban section of the city, was, by the 1980s, overrun with salvage yards, drugs, and prostitution. Investors had pulled out. This was now a majority black and poor section of the city, ominously hemmed in by water. And environmental problems known to city planners went unattended. Broom eventually left for the wider world, got a graduate degree in journalism, and honed the research and writing skills necessary to craft this sweeping memoir that situates her family's personal story within a larger narrative about race, class, and the unlevel playing field in America. Broom exposes how the ground the Yellow House was built on was pockmarked with sinkholes, geographic and economic, long before Katrina came along and blew the place off its foundation. In the summer of 2006, the city of New Orleans finished the job by demolishing the Yellow House. Broom's mother was sent one letter warning her of the destruction. But because that letter was delivered to the doomed house itself, and Ivory May was necessarily living elsewhere, she only learned after the fact that her house was gone. Out of the materials of memory and archival history, Sarah Broom's memoir solidly reconstructs what the forces of nature and institutionalized racism succeeded in knocking down.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Yellow House by Sarah Broom. Coming up, we'll hear from guitarist James Burton, who played with Elvis, Sinatra, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, Emmylou Harris, and many others. He also played in Ricky Nelson's band in the TV series Ozzy and Harriet. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. 50 years ago, Elvis Presley started performing in concert live on stage for the first time in 8 years, 8 years of making movies and records. The 1969 concert comeback was staged in the biggest showroom in Vegas, 2,000 seats, at the Las Vegas International Hotel, where he played 2 sold-out shows a night, 7 nights a week for 4 weeks. He was accompanied by an orchestra as well as a 5-piece band, which was assembled by my guest James Burton, who also backed Elvis on guitar. A new 11-CD set called Elvis Live 1969 collects recordings from 11 of those Vegas shows. James Burton continued to play with Elvis until Elvis's death in 1977. James Burton is famous in the music world for his work as a sideman. He was the guitarist on Dale Hawkins' 1957 hit Susie Q and wrote the song's famous guitar lick. Then he played with Ricky Nelson on most of his hit records and in the TV series Ozzie and Harriet. Burton has played with many performers, including Frank Sinatra, Johnny Cash, Merle Haggard, Buck Owens, Buffalo Springfield, Graham Parsons, and Emmylou Harris. He recorded sessions with Phil Spector and Brian Wilson. Let's start with a track from the new Elvis Live 1969 box set. This song, Suspicious Minds, became a number one hit, Elvis's first in 7 years. But he performed this version in Vegas before the single was released.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me? We can't go on together with suspicious minds, and we can build our dreams on suspicious minds. So if an old friend I know.
James Burton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm honored to be here.
So these 1969 Vegas concerts were recorded a year after his TV comeback special. But this was, the Vegas concerts were the first time he was like back on stage in front of a lot of people live. And he was nervous about getting on stage. I think he told you that he was afraid that he wasn't going to be able to do it. Is that right?
Yeah, he backstage, just before we went out on stage, he was very nervous. He came up to me and he said, James, I don't know if I can walk out there. And I said, Elvis, you'll have no problem. Just when you come out on stage, man, just sing maybe three or four songs just to the band. You know, we'll just key off each other and forget the audience. And after he did that, he just kind of relaxed and loosened up and he started talking to the audience. But he was very nervous. He actually hadn't been on stage in 9 years, just did movies for 9 years. And when he called me and asked me to put the band together in 69, he said that his favorite thing was to be on stage and sing to his live audience. And that's what he really missed most of all, is singing to the fans.
Was there ever a moment where you thought, he's really not going to make it, he's not going to be able to go on stage?
No, not really. He was always wound up and ready to go. I mean, all of his performances were fantastic. You know, that suit he wore weighed like 5,000 pounds. That was the heaviest suit I've ever seen. I don't have a clue how he could jump around on stage in that suit.
Let me describe it as a white jumpsuit, but it had like a zillion really large rivets on it. Going down the side, both sides of the jumpsuit, and like instead of buttons, there were rivets, like rivet buttons in the center. And then it's like a heavy white material with a big collar. Not the huge collar that he later wore, but a pretty big collar nevertheless.
It was so heavy, Terry. I got to tell you, I picked it up one day to move it off the couch, and I couldn't pick it up. It was so heavy. I really don't know how you could jump around like a little kid on stage. Wearing that suit.
I read that he rehearsed with weights on his hands and feet so that
He would do that because I guess wearing those suits and everything, he had to get ready for it, jumping around on stage.
So what was it like standing behind Elvis or to the side of Elvis on stage, facing the audience, watching the audience, watching him? Because, like, you're on stage, but, like, the eyes are mostly going to be, like, fixed on Elvis, and you're taking in the whole spectacle.
Yeah, you know, he loved guitar. He always keyed off guitar, and he'd always give me looks on stage. He'd always kind of followed me on guitar, and we had to watch him every second because he would change in the middle of a song or something. We never knew what he was going to do, so we had to watch him every second. But it was amazing. He was we couldn't get too close because he was moving so fast and kicking and a little bit of karate there. We didn't want to get our head chopped off.
So you kept playing with Elvis from 69 until his death. So you weren't in a position to watch his health deteriorate. Do you think he understood that the pills he was taking were addictive and were really harming his health?
Well, you know, I never saw him do anything or take anything. I know that sometimes he would gain a little weight, and then he would say, "Man, I got to go back on my diet. I got to slow down here and lose this weight." I've seen him gain quite a bit of weight and then lose it real fast, which is not good. But I never saw him do anything or take anything. And all the time I worked with him, I never saw any of that.
Let's talk about you and how you got started in music. You got your first guitar at age 14. Describe that first guitar that you had.
Well, my first guitar actually was when I was 13. My mother and dad bought my first guitar. And I wanted to play so bad. I had a friend in Louisiana that we kind of grew up together in school. And he was left-handed. I couldn't play his guitar, but he played. And when I got my first guitar, we sat down. And I myself taught. I taught myself to play. And my teacher was God. He was the greatest teacher in the world. He taught me how to play guitar. He gave me my direction in music. And I grew up on country music, rhythm and blues, gospel. And it was just my favorite music, country music. My favorite guitar player, my hero was Chet Atkins, Merle Travis, and Les Paul. And I wanted to play like them, which I could. I could play a little bit like them. But I woke up one day and said, "There's only one Chet, one Merle Travis, and one Les Paul. So I have to do my own thing." So I came up with a little style called chicken picking, which a lot of guitar players like to play that now. But my first guitar at the age of 13, I went professional when I was 14. I played on Louisiana Hayride when I was 14 in the staff band behind all the great, great entertainers, like George Jones and Johnny and Jack and Billy Walker, a lot of the country entertainers. And that was pretty much how I got my start. When I was 14, I wrote a little instrumental, and the singer, Dale Hawkins, actually, we recorded this little instrumental, and it became Susie Q.
Which became a big hit. So why don't we hear Susie Q? And this features James Burton on guitar and Dale Hawkins singing. And he wrote the lyric to this too, right? It was like your lick and his
lyric?
Okay. And other people have recorded this as well after the Dale Hawkins recording, which was so popular and influential. So here is my guest, James Burton on guitar, Susie Q. So that was Susie Q, Dale Hawkins, with my guest James Burton on guitar, and James Burton wrote that famous guitar lick that you heard there. So you mentioned that you developed this chicken picking style. Something else that you did to have your own distinct sound is you replaced some of your guitar strings with banjo strings. What gave you the idea to do that?
Well, you know, when I got my first Fender Telecaster, my mother and dad bought me, the strings were very stiff. And I wanted to bend the strings, but I realized that I couldn't actually do it with those strings. They're too stiff. So I decided to experiment, try the banjo strings, because banjo strings are lighter, and I wanted to try it to see if it would work. And I put the first four strings, the first, second, third, and fourth banjo strings on. And for the fifth and sixth string, I used a normal D string from the guitar. And on the E string, I used an A string. So I just went down one. And by doing that, the four strings on the banjo, I realized the third string was actually unwound. And I liked it. It was different, and the sound of the guitar was just incredible. It played so much easier. You could play any style, because I have a light touch, and it was great.
Was it easier to bend the notes too? To bend the string, to bend the note?
No, you could bend the string clear across the neck. Yeah.
So you played on Ozzy and Harriet with Ricky Nelson. And Ozzy and Harriet was a sitcom in the 50s and 60s that featured Ozzy and Harriet Nelson, who had been big band singers. I think she was a big band singer too, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was a singer. Actually, Ozzy hired her to sing in his band.
Oh, okay. So they were married and they played husband and wife, and their two sons, David and Ricky, played their two sons. And Ricky was an excellent singer, and so as when he became a teenager, the show often ended with him and his band playing like for a school dance or the prom or some party or something. And so it would be very exciting because there weren't a lot of shows, particularly like sitcoms, that had a rock and roller on performing on the show. And you were in the band. You were in Ricky Nelson's band on the show and in real life. How did that change your life to be on this really incredibly popular TV show back in the days when there were basically three TV stations? So if you were a teenager, you were watching that show.
That's correct. Before I went to work with Ricky, I met him. I was working with a guy named Bob Luman. And Bob Luman was a great singer. And we were in L.A., doing some rehearsals on some songs to record. So we were rehearsing a song called My Gal Is Red Hot, and Ricky came in one day on business while we were rehearsing, wanted to know who the band was in the next room playing. And the next day, we got a telegram from Ricky to go to the General Service Studios where they do the TV show, Ozzy and Harriet. It was amazing. We took our instruments. We met Ozzy and Harriet, David, all the people on the TV show. And so Ozzy said, why don't you guys do a song for me? So we did, and Ricky got his guitar, and I had my guitar and the bass player. And we did Mystery Train, some of the Elvis songs. Man, Ozzy said, wow, this is great. You guys want to do one on the TV show? And so that was the first introduction to doing the Ozzy and Harriet TV show. And
it was Ozzy's idea. It was the father's idea for you to do that.
Well, he wanted to put the song on the show. He said, this is great. You guys want to do this. But later on, we went back to Louisiana, my hometown, and Ozzy called me maybe 2 weeks later and asked me to come and join Ricky, be his lead guitar player. At my age, 16, I said, sure, I'd love to. I went out to California and joined Ricky, and they invited me to come stay in their home so that I became the third son.
So I'm going to play the first song that you did with Ricky Nelson in which you played lead guitar, and this is Believe What You Say.
Right.
What are your memories of playing this for the first time?
Oh, it was fun. I enjoyed the solo. I got a chance to stretch out a little bit and be in a lot of notes.
Yeah, I enjoyed the solo too. So so let's hear Believe What You Say. This is Ricky Nelson with my guest, James Burton, on guitar.
I believe what you say when you say you're going steady with nobody else but me. I believe what you say when you say you don't kiss nobody else but me. I believe, do believe, I believe, yeah, believe, pretty baby. Believe you're going steady with nobody else but me. Well, there's one thing, baby, that I want you to know. When you're rocking with me, don't rock too slow. Move on and get toe-to-toe. We're gonna rock till we can't rock no more. I believe, do believe, I believe, yeah, believe, pretty baby. Believe you're going steady with nobody else but me.
Well, let's dig it now.
Well, I believe what you say when you say you don't miss nobody else.
You know, you've had such a big influence on guitar players, and I think part of that comes from being on Ozzy and Harriet, which, like I said, like all teenagers watched it at the time. Elvis watched it. Elvis told you he used to watch it. Were you aware of that at the time, that a lot of like up-and-coming guitar players, including Keith Richards, were watching Ozzy and Harriet and being influenced by what you were doing?
Well, I found out later, but when Elvis called me and asked me to put the band together for 1969 comeback, and he said, you know, I watch the Ozzy and Harriet TV show. I watch Ricky sing and you play guitar. He said, it's my favorite show. I watch it every week. And I said, you got to be kidding. The king of rock and roll watching me on TV, watching me play guitar. But he said he loved it. He watched it every week.
Are you still playing?
Every day, every chance I get, every chance I walk by my guitar.
Well, James Burton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
James Burton is featured on guitar on the new box set Elvis Live 1969, featuring 11 concerts from his 1969 Vegas comeback. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Roberta Shorrock, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.